Good evening, everybody. My name is Zachary Weber. I'm the staff educator of adult programs here at the Science Center. I'm here to welcome you to Cafe Scientifique. Just a couple general announcements before we get started tonight. You kind of saw on some of the slides up here some upcoming events at the Science Center. One of the things that's coming up, actually we just had one last Friday, so the next one is October 4th. It's our next 21 plus night. It's a night once a month we reopen the Science Center doors just for grown-ups to come and play with all of our exhibits. No kids allowed. There's live music, cash bar. It's lots of fun. October's theme is Starry Night, so it's all about astronomy. And the weather's nice. We'll be opening up the observatory and doing some stargazing, so it should be a fun time. Also, next month, our next Cafe Sci is October 7th. So we're actually on the first Monday of the month in October. And our speaker is Michael Goh. He just published a book about the Pulitzer Air Races, American Aviation and Speed Supremacy. So he will be out here talking about the advances in engineering and aerospace technology in his new book. All right. But the reason you're all here tonight, our speaker tonight is Dr. Ila Norbash. He is the director of the Community Robotics Education and Technology Empowerment, or CREATE, lab at CMU. And he also just published a book called Robot Futures, in which he imagines a future that includes AdBots offering interactive custom messaging, robotic flying toys that operate by means of gaze tracking, robot-enabled multi-model, multi-continental telepresence, and even a way that nanobots could allow us to assume different physical forms. In Robot Futures, Norbash follows each glimpse into the robotic future with an examination of the underlying technology and exploration of the social consequences of the scenario. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Ila Norbash.
Thank you for the introduction, Zach. And it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you all for being here. And it's nice to see some familiar faces out there. So I know some of you in the crowd, and that's always useful. Let's see. I guess a good place to start is to try and balance my notes somewhere and then decide that it's impossible and put them down. Right. Second thing to do is to explain why I wrote this book and why I've been talking about this question of technology future. And one easy way to explain it is to talk about a couple of news articles that I read relatively recently. One of them was about something called the 2045 Project. Have any of you heard of the 2045 Project? All right, good. So this will be new information. The 2045 Project was something the New York Times wrote about, and they wanted to explain how this project is hoping to end world hunger. Now, to explain the project, they wanted to suppose and suggest that technology is changing so rapidly now that it's sort of on its own path forward, that it's going to rapidly change itself and the way we exist in the world. So, weighty ideas. And here's how they explained it. They said, imagine that you put, you take Lake Erie and you empty it, dry lake bed. Then you put one drop of water in it the first year. The second year, you put two drops of water in it. Now, you look at it the second year, there's not much water in it, so you're pretty underwhelmed. Third year, you put four drops of water in it, then eight, then 16. So every year, you double how much water you put in it. And, you know, after 25 or 30 years, there's a little tiny film of water along the bottom. It's really not very impressive. After 42 years, it's overflowing. And this is the kicker in the article. The number of drops of water in Lake Erie is equal to the number of neurons in your brain. So therefore, after 42 years of computer science research, we will have computers that are smarter than people. Now, there's so many issues that you can bring up with this kind of conception. But what's interesting is the New York Times made this point and then talked about the 2045 Project and explained how world hunger would disappear. Now, when I talk about the 2045 Project, it's going to sound fringe a little bit and maybe a little bit lunatic. It's not. The Dalai Lama has endorsed it. And this is Boris Itzkoff on the right, who has founded the 2045 Project. The project ends world hunger as follows. Given that, like drops of water in Lake Erie, computers are becoming exponentially more powerful, faster and faster and faster every 18 months or so, given that that's the case, by 2045, they're going to be producing mass-producing robot avatars, so robotic systems. And the idea is that in 2045, you take people who are hungry, you download their consciousness to these robots. And therefore, you've solved hunger because you no longer have hungry people. They're in the robots, and the robots don't need to eat. That's the 2045 project. It's solving the problem of hunger by installing people in robots that don't get hungry. And it's a true project, and you can go Google this at home. There's international conferences on it, and a ton of money being poured into it. And yet, computers are getting faster, and they do find ways to exceed our expectations in the future. But the ethical ramifications of what we think we're doing with computers and where we're headed is all mixed up. And it's a really interesting space that we therefore get to live and get to witness over the next few years, as computers do indeed become faster. So that's where this book comes from. There's five sections to the book, and I'm going to talk just a few remarks on each one. I'll keep my remarks relatively short so that we can go into questions and answers and have a good time with that. And the way they're going to run this is after I finish, we'll have just a few minutes of break so you can get a snack or stretch your legs. Then we'll come back and have a Q&A for as long as you wish, up until 2044. So the five sections of the book are New Mediocracy and then four others after that. And what I'm trying to do is do this portray of the world about 20 years from now, looking forward to 20 years, 20, 30 years out of China. Exactly what is it that society is like, the technology is playing a role, and what are the things we're still doing? Unfortunately, the future is being realized. If we blindly walk into the future, we're getting the knowledge of light or peace. Mic's off. How about if I do this? All right, I will speak with a deep, large voice. So New Mediocracy was the first chapter, and it's the closest impact we're going to draw into the future of where we're headed. And so let me just jump right into that. The thing about robots and computer systems that is important to understand is that they're getting better and better at observing us, at reminding what we're doing by using computer vision algorithms to look at the world. So in a way, the first wave of revolution So this video is simply showing that this computer system can very quickly tell where your eyes are, where your mouth is, what expression your mouth is making, and where you're looking. And as you start to think about computer systems doing that on ever smaller scales, you start to see where this concept of mediocrity comes from in the book. Because as computers start to observe us, they can observe with better greater detail the reactions of us, the things that are advertising in our world. Then they start to architect us. If you look at something and say, I bet that person is an ISIS. And that ISIS person looks like a liberal, and I didn't want to that, so what I'm going to do is try to make my ass. No, it's not a bad idea, I'll put it. So I'll remember that. And so the computer's an experiment. How do you actually say it? The things that are going to be practiced by computer are a little bit. And by observing us, observing our reactions, we become mice.
We become mice in a grand experiment, where the computers start to understand how we behave and how we respond to advertising. Now, what's interesting about that, and the reason I call it mediocrity, is because it changes the power relationship between marketers and us. Today, we're the unknown, and the marketers have to use intuition and graphic design to try and fool us into buying stuff. But as computers get better and better at doing that marketing job by experimenting massively on us, it's possible that they get so good at it, so in tune with each of us individually, with our archetypes, that they get too good at it. And when computers get too good at it, what does that mean? That means they can sell anybody anything, or nearly so. And so suddenly you lose your sense of free will because you're getting just the right advertising details, just the right text and audio and music into your body to cause you to respond exactly as they wish. And that's an odd place to be. So in a way, we're in danger of losing the democratic notion of personal free will and replacing it with the idea of fine-tuned responses to computers that know just how to make us respond. Now, the idea of advertising that looks at you is indeed being developed now. So this is not science fiction. There's camera systems that are being built into video billboards so that as you walk by the video billboard, the video billboard can track you with its cameras, look at where your eyes are looking, and tell whether you're paying attention to the ad or not. But it gets better. That camera system is networked into a camera system inside the store. So they can see if you walk into the store, if you look at the object that was on advertisement, if you look at the price tag, they can look at whether you scowl when you see the price tag or whether you smile. And they can track you all the way to the till to see if you actually buy it or not. So the trick that's interesting in this is they can build a long, coherent picture of your behavior, really as if you're being observed by an expert, except in this case, the expert is a machine. I'm going to give you another odd example of observation and how observing humans can change the relationship we have to technology. This is hyperactive Bob, and here's the trick that it was solving. When you are going to go to a McDonald's, the short order cook there has to make whatever you order, right? The problem is the line gets long if they don't make any French fries until you order your French fries. So what they do is they manufacture French fries ahead of time. Manufacture is about the right word, right? And they fry them and they put them on the hot plate, and they lose if nobody comes in those 5 minutes because then they have to throw them away. So Hyperactive Bob is a camera system that was developed and implemented just about 7 years ago, right here in Pittsburgh. And what it did is it looked at people's cars driving up to McDonald's and the orders they made, drive-through or going into the store. And it learned over time which cars order what food. Jeep Grand Cherokee, extra large fries. It learned this stuff, and it started telling the short order cook what to cook based on the cars that it saw coming into the parking lot. And it saved McDonald's money by essentially surveilling cars and building a model of how cars behave. Now, it's an odd example that I like to share because Hyperactive Bob is real. It was a real company. I'm not sure if it's still alive or not, but it was installed. And it's not clear what we give up, what we sacrifice. McDonald's makes more money, right, because they don't throw away as much food. We get fresh French fries, I guess, because we walk in the door and get fresh French fries. But have we sacrificed privacy? Have we lost anything that was a fundamental right we had before? When I go into the store, I can still choose not to order French fries even though I drove a Jeep Grand Cherokee, right? I still have that freedom. So it can feel as if we haven't lost anything. And that story, that conception of being under surveillance and feeling like you're not losing anything because what you're losing is so tiny, is a recurring theme that you'll find in a lot of what I say today. The Giant Eagle Advantage card is another nice idea along the same veins. My neighbor at Carnegie Mellon was one of the gentlemen who actually analyzes all shopper behavior on the Advantage card. So why do they give you a discount when you use an Advantage card? Because by using an Advantage card, you become trackable. They can tell what you specifically buy every day of the year. They can tell how often men really do buy beer when they buy diapers. And so they can develop over time an understanding of what to market with what, which things in the aisle to put where to cause you to make extra purchases. So they make a lot more money than the discount that they give you by learning about you and by then changing the store around you. So again, you're losing a little bit of privacy. You're giving up some information about what you shop for, but you're gaining sort of a convenience and a discount. And that local discount gives you this urge to do it. There was a really nice study that was just done last year where people offered a $10 discount to folks going into a supermarket and said, by the way, by taking this discount, you agree that we can look at everything you buy. And people took the discount. And then they offered them back, I've given you a $10 discount, but if you give me back the $10 discount, I'll give you an $8 discount, but I won't look at anything you buy. You'll have full privacy. And guess what? 98% of people keep the 10 bucks. So nobody's willing to barter even $2 of a $10 discount for privacy. And it starts to get you to think about where we could be headed in that direction. So really, it's an interesting question about data and about the creative development of techniques and attitudes about how we're marketed to. I'll give you another example from the cover of the book, and then I'll move on to the next section. I made the color of the book have 41 different colors of the color blue. And there's a specific reason, because it goes to a story about the question of decision-making and marketing. Google wanted a color blue for their website. And ordinarily, how do you do that? You have a graphic designer, and you instruct them, hey, graphic designer, figure out the right color blue for our website. And they had one, and they did this. The graphic designer went away, thought about fonts, and thought about different monitors. He made some treatments. He came up with two or three options and came back to management and said, here's a few options for the color blue for Google from now on. And they looked at him and said, well, but how'd you choose these three colors of blue? And he said, well, I'm an artist. I'm a graphic designer. I chose these because these are good colors of blue across all these monitors. So they dismissed that. Instead, they changed the program for how the website appears to you. What they did is they automatically generated 41 colors of blue, just spread out across the spectrum. 41 colors, randomly. And then they took those 41 colors, and what they did is every time you go to the website of Google, they would pick one of them at random and show it to you and observe your behavior. And then tomorrow you go to Google, they pick another color of blue at random and show it to you. So they were able to collect hundreds of millions of people's worth of behavior on different colors of blue. And then by looking at the behavior of the people, they chose a color of blue that they felt had the best behavior from people. Now that's fascinating, because the job that a graphic designer used to do, something people were masterful in, which is choosing colors, became crowdsourced, right? It became something done by humanity at large in behavior. But none of you were aware that you are part of a social experiment to see how you behave with different colors of blue. And nor do I even know, standing here today, if it was that different, right? Is sky blue and Persian blue cause massive differences in how much money you spend on the internet? I don't know. That would be a corporate secret. But what's interesting is, in fact, that you can start to depend on people and on statistics of how people behave to make decisions that used to be decisions in the province of humanity. And that plays into the question of what role technology plays in society. So a way to look at this as a caricature that I think is very important is that as we look at the future that we're headed into and the way technology will change our relationship to marketing and sales and decision making, it is the case that we were surveilled upon, right? We are the product of surveillance, and that we are the consumer, and that the job that the marketer had was to change our behavior as a consumer. But we had, so to speak, the agency of deciding what to buy. That was our job, right? Our part of the equation was to make an informed decision of some kind. The transition we're seeing that's really interesting is that, first of all, we're not really the consumer anymore. We're the producer. We're the creator of value. And this is a really interesting argument. My wife went to buy tickets to the symphony here in Pittsburgh. We were going to go to the symphony. There was a Bach, there was Brandenburg concertos. They were playing the whole Brandenburg concertos at the symphony here. So we went to the site to buy these. And you've seen probably when you go to buy tickets, sometimes they show you some numbers or letters, and they ask you to type these in. That's an attempt for them to make sure you're a human being. You're buying the tickets as a human. Now, sometimes you see a word. And when you see that word, sometimes it's something called reCAPTCHA, which means the New York Times is scanning all their articles from 1920, and they can't make out that one word by the computer. So the computer is showing it to you, and it's a double whammy because you prove that you're a human, and the computer finds out what that word is that it can't read. So you're actually helping the computer out. Now, what's interesting about that is you're paying twice. You're paying for the symphony tickets, and you're doing a job for the computer, but you're not getting paid for that. In fact, you're doing a job for a company called reCAPTCHA. The company called reCAPTCHA takes your reading of the word and sells it to the New York Times. And then the New York Times sells their back articles to make money. So actually, everybody makes money except you in the whole chain. So welcome to the 21st century. Now, this particular night, when we went to that site, we didn't get that regular old thing you see, which is like a word. What we got was a picture of a front of a house. And it was very clearly the top corner of the house with the house number. And it was partially obscured. And it said, what number is this? And I could see that it's a house. And I could see in the picture that it's the kind of row house that is common right on, right along Forbes between Murray and Whiteman. I could see that it's one of those kinds of houses. And we're looking at each other going, are we really going to help them identify the number of that house? And we couldn't do it. We couldn't bring ourselves to do it. So I hit, I did try again. They let you try other things. It kept giving me more houses. It wouldn't give me any New York Times. It was like they were done with the New York Times and it was time for other stuff. So now they were giving me homes. And yet, the fact that they're giving me a picture of somebody's house made it too intimate. I could no longer bring myself to do free labor for them. And it's an interesting challenge that they face in automation, but it's an interesting world that we face because we're becoming producers who bring value to other companies through our human systems. So anyway, the bottom line suggests this concept. What if we become so manipulable that, in fact, what we do is based more on the stimuli we get than on how we feel inside? Then we're robots. And so maybe the robot future is that we actually gradually become the robots in control by people's marketing. So that's this concept of new mediocrity. And if I haven't sufficiently depressed you, let's go to robot smog. So robot smog is a little further out. What's exciting about robotics is that it's becoming ever easier to build robots of all kinds. And it's becoming easier for more people to imagine being creators and inventors. I wanted to look at the dark side of this. What does it mean for everybody to build all manner of creatures and instill our world with them? So I started by looking at professional organizations, companies, and how far they've come in making robots that are really able to locomote, to move, and to act in the physical world. These are fascinating videos from more than 10 years ago, and this thing is getting better every year. What's fascinating about it is you're watching sort of human-on-robot violence, right? You're watching somebody kick a robot, and it's okay. And what's interesting is how dynamic the robot is, how sort of elegantly it can move, and how downright scary it is to imagine seeing this in a forest when you're walking in Frick Park. And so the idea of self-contained robots that can run, jump, catch a frisbee, you know, do everything a dog can do except it's a robot, which means it's harder than a dog and you don't know how to predict its behavior like you do with a dog sometime. That future is coming. You know, these robots exist. Now, I'll give you another example, which is very modern. This is called Petman. Same company. This video was just from a few months ago. This robot doesn't really look like a human, but it does look like a zombie. All the motors are inside. The only thing coming in this case is power, basically. There's the interior. And what's amazing about this is the ability to make machines that can operate in our physical world, that can kneel, that can rise up, that can climb a ladder, that can go up and down stairs. This is coming very rapidly indeed. So from a professional point of view, we're going to start to be faced by robots in our world. And by the way, when their robot is wearing a gas mask and gloves like this, will you be sure you can tell the difference between a robot firefighter and a human firefighter? I'm not so sure. So what will you do when some firefighters are human and some robots? Will you treat all the robots like they're human? Or will you not say thank you to the firefighter because you think it's a robot and it turns out to be a human and he's kind of bummed out that you're not saying thank you? It's not clear how we're going to behave. It's not clear what our relationship will be to these robots as they become more and more similar to humans in a physical realm, in a physical sense. Now, on the non-professional side, we have a whole lot of techniques that allow people to invent. And in general, I love invention, but it has really interesting boundary properties. 3D printing is something you've all heard of. You can 3D print a really cool cup holder for your coffee cup on your dash of your car. You can also 3D print a gun. And that's odd, because guns are regulated because they have to be manufactured in a plant. It's very hard to regulate something that you can build at home. It's odd. It changes the relationship we have to the built artifact when you can build a gun at home. I'll give you one very specific example of a built artifact that's really interesting in the way it was received. This is called Bumbot. In Atlanta, Georgia, a gentleman came back and decided to create an Irish-themed pub. So he bought a pub and named it O'Terrell's. And he had a problem, which is vagrants would sit on the sidewalk in front of the pub. Now, this guy was not an engineer, and he was not a roboticist. He was a classic car nut. That's all. So he took the old 1968 Camaro lights that he had. He took an old smoker barbecue grill, and he got a robot kit by mail order. And he built a robot that has a high-pressure water cannon on the front, a bright spotlight, and speakers. And then he teleoperates this thing from inside the bar and scares the bejesus off the vagrants on the sidewalk. And what's interesting about this is the response of the press. The press noted with pride that this guy was able, as a self-starter, to cook this up himself, to build it from scratch, to change his circumstance, pull himself up by his bootstraps and invent a new robot, the Bumbot. What's interesting about that is when you look at the blogosphere's response to that, it's by and large lauding this idea of the maker culture, the idea that we can invent and create. And when I look at it, I think about the response the press has and the response people have. And I wonder if people have thought exactly through this idea that we build a threatening robot with which we threaten our neighbor. What does that mean about who we are? If that makes it easier to threaten somebody because you're more indirect, the robot is now acting as the medium for threat. Will you have robot wars between neighbors who don't like each other, who cut each other's hedges down? So the idea of robot smog is fundamentally that what we face in the future, as it becomes ever easier to build our own artifacts at home, is both a land of plenty, a land in which we can be creative, but also a land in which when you go to the park, you may face somebody's crazy frisbee-catching robot that's gone slightly awry, and you may have to duck and get out of its way because it's racing down the path at 30 miles an hour. Right? We have a very odd future in which invention can actually, for the first time, impinge upon us in a way that it hasn't before. In the internet, there's lots of very annoying websites, but there's a really easy way to ignore annoying websites. You don't go there. In fact, I can close the computer and walk away, and there's no annoying flashing ads in the corners of the screen anymore. But if annoying websites become annoying robots running around in the world or flying about above your house, it's a little harder to avoid them. And that's what I consider sort of robot smog. So dehumanizing robots is another really fun category. The question here that I'm interested in is, as robots become more sophisticated, is it the case that the way we interact with the robot can change how we interact with humans? So is there a follow-on effect that robot abuse can have on human-human relationships? And I'll give you a few examples because they're actually being done by researchers today. This one's awe-inspiring, I think. Little cute robot on the right is a light-following robot. And in Australia, there's an experiment going on. These little light-following robots, you take the flashlight in the middle, and you can turn it on, and it follows the light. You can kind of walk backwards, and it follows you around, like a little insect. So what the experiment did is the gentleman in the white lab coats invite the public in, adults and children alike, and they tell them, we're testing this generation of evolutionary robots. Please take a flashlight and walk about. So you walk out with a flashlight, and it follows you, and you kind of giggle. Then they say, okay, right, you know, that one is imperfect, kill it. They give you a hammer. And you stand there, and they say, no, kill it. Kill it. It's not perfect. Kill it. And they videotape you killing it. So they videotape the severity, strength, and number of blows with which you strike the hammer and your facial expression as you destroy this small creature. That's an actual experiment being done today in Australia. I'll give you an example in America, which is along the same lines. Children come into the lab. You have a robot that's playing I Spy with a child. So the robot goes, I spy something blue and round. And the child starts looking around. And then gentlemen in white lab coat come in and say, time to go to bed, robot. Get in the closet. And the robot says, oh, I'm afraid of the dark. Don't put me in the closet. Don't put me in the closet. No. And they push it in the closet. And it says, no, don't do it. Don't do it. And it screams. And they open the closet doors, put it in, and close it. And they look at the behavior and response that the child has to the abuse that you're heaping upon the robot. So in this chapter, I talk about this question. You know, these are experiments we're doing today. And it's fascinating to think about how people will treat robots, real robots, not these toys, and how, in turn, we will treat other humans. Here's kind of a fun example. You've all heard about automated highway projects where you build cars that drive themselves. What you haven't seen is the cool full-size blow-up cars that are used to test the cars. So this is a full blow-up Mercedes. I think it'd be really fun to have one of these and just drive it around on the highway. It's a blow-up Mercedes. And so what they do is the autonomous car is behind, and they brake the Mercedes and see if it gets hit or not. And it's just a balloon, so if it gets hit, it's all right. And I like that picture because of the fact that it's a blow-up Mercedes. What's the interesting question, though, is how you will behave when some of the cars on the road are driverless and some of the cars on the road have humans in them. And in particular, when you go to a nice restaurant, you get out of your car and you go in and your car goes to park itself. Now it doesn't even have any humans inside. And it comes along and you know, by the time this is happening, by the way, every spot next to the restaurant is full because the robots keep taking the best spots. So you are annoyed. You're in your car. You're trying to park to go to the restaurant also. And so this robot car has pulled out, it turns its hazard lights on, and it says on the back, I am now parking, and there's a spot there. Will you just wait patiently for it to park, or will you take the spot yourself? There's no humans in it, right? It's just a robot car. You'll take the spot. You go to the restaurant. You might even kick the robot. Does it change you, right? Does it change the way you may bleed over in treating other cars? When you're on the highway and you see two robot cars maintaining safe distance between them, will you cut right in between them because it's a robot car? What the heck? So one of the things I find fascinating is we're designing for a world in which we will put automation side by side with humanity. And yet we haven't designed sociologically for that at all. We're just blundering into it and we will see what happens, but we aren't planning for it or inventing for that purpose. Another excellent example, Ishiguro's Geminoids, is a project now in Japan and Australia making robots that look precisely like their creators. The general idea is, by making robots that look exactly like you, you can go on business trips and still have your lab meetings. What's interesting is all the wacky things that are actually being done by these robots now. Ishiguro, for instance, has been known to have his female secretary control his robot and then have it interact with men and women variously. And then she gets weirded out about the gender mismatch between how she's being treated as a man and the woman that she actually is controlling the robot. So again, we're headed to a future in which the robots confuse the relationships we have, because we may not treat robots the way we treat humans, and we also may not treat robots that have humans behind them the way we treat humans when they're in direct communication with us. And that, I believe, can lead to really interesting unintended consequences. I'll give you one more of these sub-chapters, attention dilution disorder, which is not a new idea at all, but it takes an idea that exists kind of to the infinite limit. So you have all gone to restaurants where you can see people on their smartphones. And the best part is when you go to a restaurant and you see two people at a table, each of which is on their smartphone, right? They're just, basically they could both be in separate tables and that would be all right. The worst case of this that I see is in the playground, where I see ever greater numbers of parents standing here like this, holding their child's hand with one hand, and then on the smartphone with the other hand, thumbing. And the child's standing there like this. They don't know what to do. They're stuck. They're stuck to their parent. And the parent's busy somewhere else in a different world, basically, in their head, right? The idea of being here and now, of being in the present and making decisions with your compatriots around you is being obfuscated by your ability to be in many, many places at once. And the smartphone is a really effective way of doing that. But robotic telepresence, the idea that you can patch into a robot and take a stroll in Paris or be in a business meeting in Washington, D.C., is interesting because it makes this even more complete. Because now you can be in the playground and you can be at a board meeting in Washington, D.C. at the same time. Which means when your child asks you a question, instead of taking 5 seconds to answer because you're on your smartphone, you're going to take 15 seconds to answer you because you're in the middle of an argument about the board. So the idea that we become ever more distant from here, I believe, only becomes further the case with robots. Now, this problem becomes even more extreme as you make the integration of that robot world, or that outside world beyond, more complete in us. I particularly love this picture of the baby. You can't read this, but what it says, the baby's got one eye looking forward and one eye looking up to the right. And up there it says, this is 4 generations after the introduction of the Google Glass. So we evolve into beings with 2 eyes, right? But what's interesting about this direction, and the thing that I write about in this section of the book, is that we're not going to be content simply being at a business meeting in Washington, D.C., and going back and forth between that meeting and the here and now at the playground. We're going to want to be in 3 places or 4 places at once. And that gets tricky, because at that business meeting in Washington, D.C., sometimes we need to pay attention, right? Sometimes they're making a point about the technology, and I'm the technology officer, so I have to pay attention. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're talking about that marketing group again, and I really don't need to be paying attention. So what do I need? I really need the computer listening for me. So the computer can tell me, hey, they're talking about the technology now. And then I swivel in and pay attention to that conversation, right? It gets even better than that. It's the end of the meeting and we're scheduling the next meeting. Wouldn't it be great if the computer said, hey, I know how to do the schedule. I have your schedule. You go ahead and attend to your other existences. And the computer can take over for me at that point and say, yeah, I can do Thursday next week, no problem, 9 o'clock and 10 o'clock. And over time, it can even have my voice, right? It could have my cadence, it could have my prosody, it could have my idioms. So you can head into a world in which your ability to patch into different parts of the world and have conversations and meetings become essentially, they become mediated by your digital assistants, your robot digital assistants. Now, lest you think this is far in the future, today you can use products like Google Now so that when you're running late to a meeting and it can see your position because you have your position on your smartphone, and it can see that your meeting is 20 minutes away and you're 45 minutes away, it can text the person you're meeting with and tell them that Elon's going to be 25 minutes late. So what's that mean? That means that the robots are essentially becoming our personal assistants. Now, the only people I know who have personal assistants that can do all that are very wealthy people. And the wealthy people I've met who have personal assistants that do that, they do everything for them. They even tell them when it's time to stop talking to this gentleman, sir, we have to go, we have another engagement over here. So we could be headed into this odd world where we're each very wealthy individuals with personal assistants that tell us, no, you got to go. You have a business meeting. The traffic is bad. I checked. You have to leave now, otherwise you'll be late. And I've already told them to order the catering food for you. Oh, and I got a birthday present for your daughter because that's tonight and you forgot. Robots will do that, and people will purchase that product. And as they purchase that product, their ability to be here and now becomes ever further diluted, just like that of a wealthy individual. Instead, they become a puppet that's controlled by puppeteers, except in the odd world of this that I'm imagining, those puppeteers are actually pieces of technology you bought as a convenience feature. So that's a very odd place to go, but I believe we're headed there. And robots help make that possible by giving us remote eyes and ears anywhere we wish. Now, when I was writing this book, I wrote the book and MIT Press read it, and they said, this is really depressing. Can you please give it a happy ending? And so I added a last chapter. And the last chapter was about what can we do differently? What is it about technology that causes us to be willing to give up privacy, to give up decision making, to give up personal and authentic empowerment to others through technology, to have some kind of weird better life? And how can technology not do that? How can it empower us instead of disempowering us? How can it increase our ability to understand data rather than causing us to, in a disenfranchised way, make data for other companies to use? And so that interesting question leads to this question of what's an interesting way forward. There's a really interesting direction that Nielsen has been going recently. They have 100,000 new boxes on set-tops in Denver, Colorado, that don't simply look at what channel you're on. They look at what eyes are in the room, where the eyes are looking, whether they're conversing with each other, whether they're leaving and going away to the kitchen and coming back or not. So that surveillance and the marketing and the value of that surveillance is inside your home even, looking at what you do. So the countervailing question becomes, how can we take this idea of data, this idea of making meaning from data, and make it authentically useful for people, for us, for the community, rather than simply for business? And the picture that I draw that'll take you to this last part of what I wanted to say, then we'll take our break. The picture that I draw is this, and I want to explain that picture. I believe we've fundamentally lost the comprehension and the understanding of the relationship we have to technology. I believe what's missing is we've become consumers of technology, and we've become used to having an expectation that companies will produce technology, and then we will consume it as produced. Because in so doing, we become actually automatons. We become the robots. And an alternative viewpoint to have about technology is rather than to think of us as literate, rather than to think of us as able to download an app onto an iPad and then use it as intended, what we call fluent. Because when you're fluent, you don't simply know how to read. You know how to create argument. You know how to tell a story. You know how to convince somebody else of your point of view. And if you're technologically fluent, I argue, you can take technology and turn it on its head. You can hijack technology and do with it the thing that you actually care about in your community. But it's not just technology fluency we need. The amount of data in the world is increasing massively. Everything from weather phenomena to health statistics are exploding in quantity to the point where we can't make sense of it all. We can't even make sense of the energy we use in our home to decide how to save energy. It's too much data. So we need another kind of fluency too, what I call data fluency. I'm afraid we need to learn statistics. We need to learn how to deal with massive numbers of numbers and how to make sense of it and help make better decisions through it. And the last thing we need, and this is something that's often missing, teaching a STEM class in a school where you teach somebody to use Excel and you teach them how to program a lemonade stand game simply isn't enough. And the reason is you haven't tied the lemonade stand, nor have you tied the Excel sheet into the real world they live in and the actual issues they face. But if their brothers and sisters have asthma, if you can have them do research on asthma and then study air quality and then study data about air quality in their neighborhood and then use technology to create a device that measures air quality and shows it off or demonstrates to their parents how smoking causes the air in their house to get worse, That is an argument. Now you've taken technology and you've taken data and you're using them to affect the world around you in a way that you actually personally feel intimately is important to you. And that, in my opinion, is what technology should be for. So we have a lab at Carnegie Mellon, as Zach said, the Create Lab. And just to give you a few examples of projects that we have that try and do this, both from very, very early childhood development all the way through adult, I want to just give you a sense of what it means to take technology and treat it this way. And I'll be very brief about this because you can always look this stuff up. One excellent example that some of you may have seen was co-produced by Time Magazine and Google and our lab. It's called Time Machine, or Time Lapse. It was exciting because they took video satellite images of the Earth from 1984 until the present. And they were able to create moving, fluid, zoomable images that show change over time. And in fact, the principal investigator is Randy, who's sitting right there in the audience. What's exciting about that is that you can go into the Amazon. You can zoom in to the point where you can see trees being cut down in 1984. And then you can see how there's more trees being cut down in 85 and 86. But then you can zoom out, and you can see rows of trees being cut down in 87, 89, 90, 91. Then you can zoom out more, and you can see hundreds of rows of trees being cut down. Then you start understanding the problem. Then you pull back all the way till you see the eastern and western edges of the continent, and you realize the entire middle has been cut down. And then it hits you that at the continental level, we're taking trees out. You don't get that. The human being doesn't simply get that from a piece of prose. But when you can interact with that data and zoom in and out and see change over the course of 30 years, it's a different picture. Because you learn it. You understand it. The same way you do when you see a beautiful dance performance. So fundamentally, this is about taking the most important data in the world, which is the data of our Earth over time, and making it available to everybody on Earth. So you can view anywhere in the world and see the changes over time. That's an example of data empowerment, right? It's not disenfranchising you. Rather, it's providing you with the data that enfranchises upon you the ability to start having a role in policy decisions. Utterly different example, but just as important, is a project called Arts and Bots. This is an example where they don't take technology and simply make robots that collect ping pong balls. Instead, they learn how to use circuit boards and foam core and feathers and glue and cardboard to build sculptures. But then what do they use the sculptures for? Oh, and they learn to program them so they can dance and swing and play lights. So they can make a little rabbit, right? Nice furry rabbit on the front, big mess of electronics on the back. And you can have eight-year-olds do this, but what do they do with them? They take Edgar Allan Poe, and they read a poem like El Dorado. And they read the poem, and they spend 2 weeks reading the poem over and over again. This is not what you usually do in English class in middle school. And they spend 2 weeks reading it and deciding what should a physical manifestation of that poem be. Then they build a robot that they believe represents El Dorado. Then we get messages from the kids, like the one we got from these two ladies. And the message was, after 2 weeks, I finally got it. It's about death. You don't get that by reading the poem once in school. You get that when you're forced to confront the poem, the timing of the poem, the language, the prosody, and you read it over and over again for 2 weeks, and you have to build a sculpture around it. Then you get that. And so fundamentally, technology can actually slow us down if it's a creative art. It can force us to pay greater attention to detail because we're trying to make something intangible tangible. And that forces us to understand what the important parts are. And that's a really important aspect of technology. Another interesting example is water quality. Throughout West Virginia, we have a lot of partners who have issues with water quality for a number of resource extraction reasons. And what's interesting is people don't know what to do about it. They have that 9-mile run, in this case, in Pittsburgh, but they don't know how to measure the water quality or how to visualize how bad it's getting. They just know that they're anxious about it. So we make a series of sensors, called WaterBot in this case, that children can put in the river, measure the water quality over time, visualize it on a map, and start to feel like they're adopting the river and measuring that value. Now they can be part of an advocacy group. They can advocate for changes to make the watershed better. But it's very hard to feel like you have that power when the people measuring the water quality are hired by the corporation and they're very, very expensive consulting firms. But when you turn that power pyramid over and you let the individual community member be the one who's measuring the water quality and making the case in the watershed organization meeting, that changes the game. because now you're not simply hearing very highfalutin talk from that consultant. You're hearing your neighbor talk about what she did in the river last weekend and what numbers she got. Almost done. I'm just going to do one more because of time. This is the Children's Innovation Project. And, you know, one of the things we talk about a whole lot in our community is digital literacy, digital media literacy. And a lot of people debate, you know, how early should people use an iPad? You know, how soon is it too soon? And, well, it's important for people to learn how to swipe because, you know, if they don't know how to swipe, how will they grow up, right? The problem with using an iPad or using any kind of computer system like a video game is that you are typically a consumer, right? It's a designed artifact. It's like going to Walt Disney World. And you're using something precisely the way it was intended to be used. What you're not doing is expressing your creative nerve, your ability to take something, hijack it, come up with a new plan, and incorporate it. And one of the interesting projects that I've seen, run by a gentleman named Jeremy Boyle here on the upper right, is called Children's Innovation Project. They take very simple circuit pieces. This is a little It's a knife switch. Thank you, a knife switch. And that's a little LED and an incandescent light bulb and some batteries and little alligator clips and wires. They don't build a complex circuit. They spend months building the simplest possible circuits, sketching them in kindergarten, and then undoing them and trying their own open-ended experiments. And over the course of a year, developing language for what parallel means, what series means, what voltage is, how voltage is like pressure, what current means. What happens to people over time, to children in kindergarten making circuits like this, is that by the end of the class, they go to Goodwill and they get free toys, electronic toys. They learn how to use a Phillips screwdriver, which, by the way, a lot of children don't know how to use anymore today. They unscrew the toys, they can take it apart, they can identify all the parts inside the toy. Then they can snip them carefully, connect their circuits to them, and make new toys out of old toys. In kindergarten, the only reason they can do this is because you slowed them down. You taught them observation, you taught them patience, and you didn't give them a goal line, collect 15 ping pong balls and beat the other team. You told them to explore, open-ended, learn and understand everything they possibly can about the simplest of systems with little pieces of wood and alligator clips. That should be what digital media literacy is about. And that's not what digital media is today. I believe if we could start people there so they understand fundamentally the importance of observation, then we can make them into advocates in the future for technologies that actually do cause society to improve. But today, we are busy talking about the singularity and about immortality and about Lake Erie. And as long as we are excited and dazzled by the idea of solving world hunger by downloading our consciousness, we don't get that the realistic challenges we face in robotics and the future of robotics are much more clear and present. They're much closer term, and they will already have impact on society way before we have immortality and all that nonsense. So anyway, that's a general introduction. I have one final slide for you, which is if you like these ideas and you're curious to read more, here's some recommended books. I struggled, but I only had 7 books, so I put mine on there just to make it even. It's the only reason it's there. Race Against the Machine is a really interesting book about the question of how automation is changing the dynamics of unemployment and how very rapidly now middle employment is being basically taken out by automation. Everything from milling to machining to aspects of the service industry are being replaced pretty rapidly. So you have highly productive companies with high profit margins, and you have fewer jobs, and as a result, chronic underemployment. Developing countries are seeing this too, by the way, but we have a lot of this right here. That book is fantastic because it shows how this is not the Industrial Revolution again. You can't simply say, well, the Industrial Revolution was fine, we'll be fine. That argument doesn't quite fly for some really interesting reasons. Digital Labor is a fantastic book looking at how we are now the ones doing all the work that brings value to the companies that derive the stock value from our work and how our being on the internet, it was gives companies like Facebook their value. Yet we don't get paid for that, right? We are simply producers for them, essentially. We have entire websites that work like that, such as the Huffington Post. Another interesting one is iRobot. This is probably the most well-developed book by somebody who believes in the singularity. Hans Moravec, who's a friend of mine here in Pittsburgh, wrote that book to talk about the impending singularity when robots will overcome humans. And he has arguments in there that are, I think, more eloquent than any other book in which they make this argument about how robots will basically overtake us and be our evolutionary progeny. And last one I'll call out is just Wired for War, P.W. Singer. Really interesting book about how robotics is being integrated into the Defense Department and how it's changing how war happens and how it's changing trauma and stress that soldiers face in ways that were not at all predictable ahead of time. So that's it for the formal presentation. I think, Zach, we're supposed to take a little time out. How long do you want to take time out? All right, so 10-minute time out. I'll be up here, so you're welcome to ask me questions, and then we'll do a Q&A.